content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halaf. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. My dear listeners, today we will hear about blasts from the past, landline telephones, and dimes. Not really sure what these items are? You are not alone. These relics of the past are indeed relics for a reason. First, we'll hear about how really not to get rich from Bill Lepp. From his book, Armadillo Recon Unit and Other Tall Tales, published in 2004, the chapter, Dimes. On New Year's Day, when I was 11, I made a resolution. I decided what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be rich. And to be rich, I knew, you had to have $1 million. So, I knew exactly what I had to do. I had to find and save $1 million bills. How hard, I thought, could that be? It was my 1981 New Year's resolution. I started doing more chores around the house. I raked leaves for neighbors, I washed cars, I pulled weeds, I shoveled snow, and by the end of the first week, I had collected and saved 8 $1 bills. At that rate, I calculated it was going to take something like 125,000 weeks to become rich. Just for a point of reference, that is 2,403.84 years. Even if I factored in the odd $10 for a birthday here and there, it was obvious that I was not going to be able to collect enough $1 bills to be rich by the time I was grown up. Clearly, I needed a new plan. I decided that I would still go on earning and collecting $1 bills when I was searching for a new idea, and so I went door to door asking folks if they would pay me a dollar for this or that. I got a great many dollars this way, and what I began to notice was that if I did a really fine job, people would invariably give me a little extra something for my troubles. That little extra something was usually a dime or two. I would go home at night and put my dollar bills carefully in a shoebox and then throw the dimes on my desk. One night, after I had counted my dollars, I had 14, I decided to count my dimes. I had 16. It occurred to me that people pretty much just gave dimes away. Dollars they hung on to. You had to work hard for at least an hour to get a dollar. But people just gave you dimes. I did some math. I only needed 10 million dimes to be a millionaire. Now by this time, I was working about 8 hours a day doing various tasks for people, and thus earning about $8 a week. What I realized was that if I did smaller jobs and only charged a dime per job, I could probably squeeze as many as 16 jobs into a week. That was 16 dimes. I could, I realized, earn twice as many dimes in a week as I could dollars. I was off and running. I decided it would be wise to turn my dollars into dimes, and to turn my paper money into hard cash. I didn't, however, know exactly how to accomplish this. I had once heard my mother speak of a mythical place called the Dime Store. I wondered what sort of dimes they sold at the dime store, and how many you could buy for a dollar. It worried me that if there was such a place, it might mean that other folks had already struck on my get-rich scheme. But I reckoned there were probably enough dimes to go around. The next day, I searched the town high and low for the dime store, but it was nowhere to be found. It was, I figured, the Valhalla of dime men like myself. So I put my dreams of a dime store to rest and took my 14 $1 bills to the bank, where I cashed them in for dimes. The dimes, I found, cost about $1.20 a dozen. I now had 140 dimes from the bank, plus the 16 I had at home, for a total of 156 dimes. That was more than 10 times as many dimes as I had had dollar bills. I was rolling in the dough. Neighbors practically lined up to have me wash their cars, sweep their basements, haul their garbage to the curb, walk their dogs, whatever, and all at a dime a shot. I would, if pressed, accept tips, but only dimes, never nickels or quarters. By the end of my first few months in my quest to be a millionaire, I had gathered just over 1,000 dimes. At most, I figured I could have only collected $150 in the same amount of time. I was way ahead of the game. I began collecting old bottles from stream beds and roadsides, all of which were worth a dime apiece. I'd stick my finger in every payphone return coin slot and from time to time would turn up a dime. One summer day, my mom gave me $2. I went right to the store, bought some lemonade and paper cups, and set up a stand. I sold the lemonade for 10 cents a cup, and I turned those $2 into 17 dimes. Word got around town that I was collecting dimes, and, kindly, people would just hand them to me on the street. Pretty soon, my shoebox was overflowing with dimes. I could barely lift the box. I started filling coffee cans, mason jars, paper cups, anything that could hold a dime. I stashed them under my bed, in the closet, and in the drawers of my desk. I went into the attic and found an old dry-rotted canvas duffel bag. I stood it in the corner of my closet and poured all my dime containers in that bag. For Christmas, all I asked for was dimes. No toys, no dollars. Just dimes. My grandmother gave me 100 dimes, all in neat little paper rolls. My parents honored my wishes and gave me 500 dimes in a money bag from the bank. Old Saint Nick brought me another 500 dimes. When I lost a tooth, I left a note for the tooth fairy. It said, "Please, no quarters, just dimes." It worked. Instead of the quarter I normally got for a tooth, I got 2 dimes. I am here to tell you that saints, folks, and fairies would much rather give you 2 or 3 dimes than a dollar any day of the week. But it's not nice to laugh. You know what they say, there is a sucker born every minute. It was hard for me to not become jaded in my wealth or to start taking advantage of people. The day after Christmas, I started counting the dimes I had collected in the duffel bag. It took me a week. There was a sea of dimes stacked all across my bedroom floor. By the end of my first year in my quest to save 10 million dimes, I had collected just shy of 10,000 dimes. When the sun shone through my window, the dimes which were spread across my floor sparkled and glittered like a great sequined dress. Any disco owner—this was the '80s after all— would have killed for my floor, but I wouldn't have traded my 10,000 dimes for $5,000. I needed, I realized, to get the dimes out of my bedroom and into hiding. I spent a precious few of the dimes at the surplus store and bought 4 more canvas duffel bags. I put the duffels in the attic and then slowly carried coffee can after coffee can of dimes up the attic stairs until I had 5 massive bags of dimes leaning beside the attic's trap door. I folded the stairs up and went back to my room. On I went, saving dimes well into the summer. And then, like in all great fiscal adventures, troubles arose. The first sign of trouble was what the papers called the Great Dime Shortage of 1982. I don't know how many dimes are supposed to be in circulation in any given town, but half dollar began to run out of dimes. Well, that's not exactly right. There were plenty of dimes in half dollar. It's just that they were all in my attic. People didn't want 2 nickels or 10 pennies for change. Customers started complaining to merchants about the dime shortage, and the merchants complained to the bank. The bank, I guessed, complained to the U.S. Mint, and they apparently called the Secret Service. The next bump in my road to monetary bliss came when 2 agents from the Secret Service showed up in town one day and started working out the Great Dime Caper. They questioned folks up and down the streets about where all the dimes had gone, and pretty soon suspicion fell on me. Early one morning, there was a knock on the door. I opened the door and found two well-dressed men showing me their badges. "Son," they asked, "why are you hoarding dimes?" "Dimes?" I asked, trying to look confused. They stepped into the house. The final trouble in my dime collection scheme started slowly. The agents were just inside the doorway of our house, at the base of the stairs, when my mother came into the hall. The agents were in the process of explaining to her what they were there for when something went bump in the attic. The attic that had one of those pull-down staircases that disappeared into the ceiling when you pushed it back up into place. Those pull-down stairs were located in the ceiling of the landing at the top of the stairs going from the first floor of our house to the second floor. The bump we had all heard seemed to have come from that general direction. "What was that?" the agents asked as they started up the stairs. "That?" I asked. "Oh," I said, "that was just one of my dime bags." The agent looked at me, puzzled. "Dime bags?" "Yep," I confessed. "I have five of them." "You have five dime bags?" I nodded. He looked at my mother and frowned. He asked me, "Is it grass, weed, coke, snow, angel dust, LSD? I nodded. I said, "Well, I cut grass, pulled weeds, hauled coke bottles, and shoveled snow for them. I'm not sure about the angel dust, but the tooth fairy helped me out some. And I don't know about LSD. I think it's FDR. "Partner," the first agent said to the second, "you'd better call the DEA. And then, like water dripping through the ceiling, a dime fell through the attic's trap door, bounced on the landing, and then rolled down the stairs. We all stared at it. And then another dime dropped. And then another. The time between the dropping dimes grew shorter and shorter. Suddenly, a stream of dimes poured out of the attic and bounced down the stairs. And then, just as suddenly, the trap door sprang open, the fold-away stairs shot out, and a wave of dimes rolled down toward us. The agents were backing down the stairs when they were swept up in a rolling, bouncing, glittering avalanche of dimes. The wave pulled my mother and me with it. 20,000 dimes carried the G-men, my mother, and myself out the door. The dimes carried us halfway across the yard before they stopped. The four of us lay still. We were all exhausted from trying to keep afloat in the money. We were spent. It is not illegal to collect dimes. It's not even illegal to hoard dimes, but fate and fortune can be cruel when you are 12 years old. I was only 9,980,000 dimes shy of my goal when the bottom fell out. I sat in the yard under the glare of the two agents, my mother, and 20,000 images of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It took me the rest of that day, and most of the next, to shovel all of those dimes into the back of Dad's pickup truck. It took the bank nearly a week to count and roll all of those dimes. The bank manager asked me how I wanted the dimes converted. When I said, "Nickels, please," he nearly fainted. In the end, they gave me 20 $100 bills. $100 bills are almost useless to a 12-year-old. My folks wouldn't let me do anything with them, but put them in an interest-bearing account. "For your college education," they said. When it was all said and done, I never got rich. I never got anything out of those dimes at all, except a college diploma. But what good is a diploma when you don't have a dime to your name? Ah, to be young and think that more dimes than dollars was a bargain. Speaking of bargain, okay, so there's really not a way to segue into our next topic, so let's just dive in. The landline telephone. Lori Notaro pulls from yet another relic, her 90s newspaper column, to regale us of how desperate people were, and maybe weren't, to have a landline phone. From her book, Enter Pirates, Vintage Legends, 1991 through 1999, copyright in 2016, the chapter, Hello, Goodbye. It was kind of like waiting to go to the gas chamber. I knew it was coming, but I didn't know when, and I knew I wasn't going to like it. And I was completely and utterly powerless to do anything about it. The plug was about to be pulled on my phone, my umbilical cord, my extension to the outside world, and one of my favorite reasons for living. I had been notified of this, receiving threats in the mail for the past 4 weeks. Initially, the phone company was sympathetic. The first threat was simply a reminder, because, as they put it, they understood that sometimes bills are overlooked and forgotten. It was a kind and warm letter. I smiled when I read it. It seemed so, well, caring. The second notice, however, took on a slightly different tone, and they let me know, in not so many words, that the phone company was a little pissed at me. In other words, shame on Lori for not paying her bill. In the third letter, it was apparent that our relationship had suffered and would continue to degenerate until I coughed up the balance due, and I found that quite selfish and absolutely one-sided. I immediately mangled the letter and threw it in the trash. "Who did they think they were talking to?" I screamed. "They were not the boss of me." When I was served with the fourth and final letter, however, the phone company announced that they wanted a divorce. I cried. I was stunned that they could be so cruel after we had spent so many quality years together. Every day after that last letter, the first thing I did when the sun went down and I woke up, aside from reaching for a cigarette, was check to see if the phone still had a pulse. And for 5 days, the phone rang and gurgled, hummed and laughed, and we both lived each day as if there were no tomorrows. On the fifth day, however, when I reached for the phone, its touch was stiff and cold. I picked up the receiver in an action of denial, positive that I would hear that familiar and loving tone, but only silence filled my ears. The only way I can describe it is that the world exploded and froze in the same instant. My baby fell from my hands to the floor. It was dead. "You bastards!" I cried in a scream that left my body and went shrieking through the air, my hand in a fist shaking towards the sky. "How could you do this? How could God allow this to happen?" I shrunk to the floor, my head in my hands, and I wept. I wept for the phone. I wept for myself. I wept for all the people that I needed to call to inform them that I no longer could call them. I no longer had a phone. I no longer had a phone number. I no longer had an identity. I no longer had a soul. I had become nothing. I panicked. I ran to my sister's house in my hour of need and pounded on the door. When she saw me, she collected the shell of a human being that I had been reduced to and took me inside. "What happened?" she asked me, but I could say nothing. All I could do was shake my head. "Did you get stood up again?" she said, handing me a tissue to blow my nose. I shook my head. "Did someone tell you you were fat?" I shook my head. "Did Mom and Dad cut you off monetarily?" I shook my head. "Did your boyfriend get another girl pregnant?" I shook my head. "Did he get sentenced to prison?" "No," I sobbed. "That's next week." "Are you upset about turning 29, spending 12 years in college, and still not having a degree, being a drunk and so financially irresponsible that no bank will allow you to have a checking account?" "No," I countered. "My phone got shut off." "Oh, well, maybe you should get a "Do not say that filthy word to me, do not," I said to her, holding my finger up. "Just because you have one doesn't mean that I have to have one too. Don't even say it." She looked at me for a second, her brow furrowed. She was thinking about it, I could tell. She was contemplating it. She was forming it, and then she did it. It just flew from her mouth like a rabid bat. "Get a job!" The word echoed through the house like a gunshot. It bounced off each wall, hit me in the head, and then fell in my lap. "I can't believe you did that," I mumbled, still dizzy from the assault. "I never knew you could be so vile and wicked." "If you got one, maybe you could get cable," my sister tempted, and for a moment she must have seen my eyes spring forth, because then she added, "And you could also buy food." "I want cable," a little voice inside my head sang. "Cable is the most beautiful thing in the world besides whiskey. I used to have cable a long, long time ago, before the cable company also divorced me and ripped the wires out of my TV set right before my eyes. To this day, I'm still having nightmares about it, as well as panic attacks whenever I come in contact with any man in a blue jumper that rings my doorbell. "So let me get this straight," I said to my sister. "You think if I get one of those things, that I could get my phone back, I could get cable, and also eat?" She nodded with a smile. "So I could watch TV, get drunk, eat ding-dongs, and talk on the phone all day?" "Not really," she added. "You would have to spend the daytime at work." "Oh, I don't like that," I informed her, and decided that I would have to ask my friend Patty for advice. I found him on the porch at Long Wong's, splitting a pitcher of beer with my other friend, Jeff. They both jumped up when they saw me. "We thought you were dead," Patty exclaimed. "Your phone got disconnected." "I know," I answered. "My sister thinks that if I get a J-O-B, that I could get it back." "Oh my God," Jeff muttered. Patty, on the other hand, had begun to scream. "Calm down," I assured him. "Nothing is definite yet." "You could do a million things besides get one of those," Jeff proclaimed. "You could have a baby and sell it. You could stand outside of Circle K and beg for change like those hippie kids do," Patty suggested. "That wouldn't work," I answered. "They all drive nicer cars than I do." "Sell your hair to the wig factory people," Jeff threw in. "Yeah, I could do that," I agreed. "But I hate shaving my legs." "Wait," Patty said, a proud smile expanding over his face. "I know how you can make a ton of money." I could tell that he was about to become my savior with the brilliant miracle that was bubbling inside his brain. As I waited silently for his answer, I heard my phone ringing from a distance like a child crying out in despair for its mother. My salvation was seconds away. I almost had my baby back. I was that close. "Phone sex," I heard my baby scream. Still not getting the idea of how impactful the landline phone was? Don't worry. These phones from Pamela Paul will help fill in some of the remaining blanks. From her book, quite aptly named, 100 Things We've Lost to the Internet, published in 2021. Chapter 20. The Phone in the Kitchen. The phone in the kitchen was the all-powerful hub, the portal between the family inside and the outside world, and the only way for a stranger to get into the house without physically walking through the front door. When that phone rang, everyone wanted to be the first to pick up and find out who was on the other line, even, or perhaps especially, when it wasn't for you. "Get off the phone!" your sister would scream from upstairs. "You can hang up now!" you called out to your dad. "Mom, he won't hang up in the kitchen!" I can hear you breathing! We all yelled at one another. The phone in the kitchen always had one of those long, coiled wires that attached the receiver to the base, the better to cook by or pull into a nearby nook in an attempt at privacy. You could spend hours endeavoring to redirect the coils that exasperatingly curled in the wrong direction midway, furling and unfurling the plastic-coated wires like a Rubik's Cube. Small children, undeterred by warnings of sure death by electrocution, gnawed on them, drawn by what was an almost irresistible chewy texture and a very pleasant give. The semi-hard plastic tasted like toy packaging. Yes, I remember it well. It was a big deal when you were old enough to answer the phone yourself, and you were issued clear instructions. Always answer with a bright, "Hello," and say, "May I tell her who's calling?" No calling after 10 p.m. No calling on Sunday before noon. No talking on the phone longer than 30 minutes. Never make a long-distance call without asking permission. Later, when call waiting and caller ID were introduced, certain parents thought the very concepts were rude, not to mention overpriced. What an extravagant notion to know who was calling when you could just pick up and find out. These were the same parents who, upon hearing the phone ring at an inopportune moment, glared at it, muttering, "Who on earth could be calling now?" Now that almost nobody has a landline, the family phone no longer reveals the comings and goings between the people inside and outside the home. What was once transparent is opaque. Parents no longer take calls for their kids or see a log of numbers on an itemized monthly bill. The ways in which kids communicate with their friends are encrypted or ephemeral. Parents don't know whom their kids are talking to behind locked screen devices, nor can they glean insight from overheard snippets of conversation, tearful exchanges, and slammed receivers. They don't know whom their daughter is dying to hear from and who their son is dreading might call. Little did parents appreciate how much they could learn from a simple, "Tell him I'm not home." We've run out of time for today's episode of That's Halaf. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's Halaf is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any comments or questions about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.